January 23rd, 2014. This is the Hermetic Hour. I'm your host, Pope Runyon, and tonight I will present a discussion on the 23rd path of the Kabbalistic Tree of Life, leading from the sphere of Hod to the sphere of Geburah on the Pillar of Severity. Now, this path is attributed to the element of water and to the tarot trump, the Hanged Man. Now, once again, our texts for reference will be Gareth Knight's Practical Guide to Kabbalistic Symbolism and John Michael Greer's Paths of Wisdom. Now, we will delve into the history and the mystery of the strange Hanged Man card and give you our own unique interpretation of its meaning from Greek mythology. So, if you want to cross stormy seas to Anath's castle on the edge of forever, be sure to join us for another exciting adventure in the land of Otzkeim, or the Yetzira dimension of the Otzkeim. Now, before we get too far into this, I want to say that we have a guest call-in number, 347-857-1830, and we would very much like you to call in and ask questions and try to keep the questions on the topic. And that would be this particular path of the Tree of Life, but it could be anything on the Tree of Life that you want to ask. I'm not sure we can answer it, but we'll sure try, and we'll discuss it. So let's hear from you. Now, that guest call-in number is 347-857-1830. Now, let me review a little bit here on the structure and our particular methods of doing these path workings. We use, as I think you, all of you who are regular listeners know, we use a magical device, a magical vehicle, as it were, for exploring the higher spheres of the Tree of Life. And this is a boat, and we call it Kusar's boat, because Kusar and Kasis Tubal-Cain was the original artificer of Canaanite mythology. He was the craftsman god, the blacksmith god, and he has a counterpart in almost every mythology. Hephaestus and the Greeks, and Vulcan with the Romans, and Wayland Smith, and you know, these the craftsman god fell with the course of the Egyptians, and he's very closely related to and almost in some cases interchangeable with both of the Egyptians. In one case, in Canaanite mythology, in one of the Canaanite myths, they actually sent down to Egypt for him because they needed him. So Kusar was supposed to be, according to Canaanite mythology, the inventor of the fishing boat. Well, that's where they started off, you know, 10,000-11,000 years ago with fishing boats, and then they went from there to ocean-going ships and whatever. So Kusar started that. So we thought that if we needed a magical vehicle to explore these higher paths, so we wouldn't have to walk the path to a sphere and then get there and then walk the path to the next sphere. You know, in other words, if we wanted to, once having done a particular lower sphere, we could then have our boat that we could use to fly over what we had already walked over and then land and walk the path up to the sphere. So this was a very practical idea. And so we created this version of Cousteau's boat. And you can see that, those of you who are associate members, and you have your pathworking video, you can see Cousteau's boat there on the altar, ready to fly through the cell door. And those of you who are not associate members, you know, that's not very difficult to accomplish. Just go to the Hermetic Hour website, and we feature the episode on the associate member program and pathworkings up there at the top, and just listen to that episode, and that'll teach you, tell you how to do that. And then we have, of course, these pathworkings are all, well, all the lower ones are recorded. And we put a lot of work into that. They're recorded, and we have a video, a visual lead-in, and all of these is a real nice set. And you'll see Cousteau's boat there in the end on the altar. Now, the boat has a, it's an ibis pattern, and it has a, you know, it has a black on the port side. It's all black, and on the starboard side it's all white, and the wings are folded. But of course, you know, in your imagination, you can unfold the wings when you take off with the boat. But they're folded on the side, and it has an ibis beak. And we've got a compass mounted on that boat, and we have a little cockpit and a rudder and a tiller and everything. It's a nice little boat. It owes something to Abraham Merritt's Ship of Ishtar, if any of you are familiar with that. And then it also owes something to various Egyptian funerary boats for sailing the starways and what have you. So we use the boat, and this pathworking, the reason why I'm going into this at some length is because tonight's pathworking would definitely be a boat working. Not only would it be a boat working from Malkuth all the way up to Hod, but we would just keep on flying, because the way this path is, the path of water that leads from Hod to Gomorrah. So we could do our whole working virtually from the boat, and I'll explain to you how we do that. But first, let's talk about the Spear of Hod, and then a little bit about the Spear of Gomorrah, and this will make the path working make a little more sense out of it. One of the things, too, that I'd like to point out as we get into this is that the paths themselves, the way that the Golden Dawn and the Golden Dawn magicians developed the path workings and the path ideas, it frankly places, I think, too much emphasis on the symbolism and the attributes and the symbolism of the paths, because and the spheres they get sort of short shrift. I mean, if you think about it, the spheres are really more important than the paths. The paths get you to the spheres, and the spheres represent the great principles of the universe. They represent their worlds in themselves that represent these principles and these major themes. They're the great filing cabinets, to use Rigardi's expression. And so, but the emphasis ended up being placed in the Golden Eye, being placed on the paths. And the tarot cards were applied to the paths. And so we tended to work the paths, and they were the active aspect. And the Hebrew letters were applied to the paths. And so the formulas, the magical formulas, get applied to the paths. And we do all this work with the paths, and then we tend to kind of forget the spheres. And so when we started to do path workings, and naturally we, we started inspired by Kirpal Singh's his Sikh-Sant Asiatic version of path workings, which gave us the attention point system. I've got a call. Who am I speaking with? Who am I speaking with? Are you on? You're on the Hermetic Hour. In honest, are you gonna? Well, come on, breathe for me. Okay, all right, but we go on. Anyway, these paths. To get back to, I said Kirpal Singh's was the inspiration for our pathworking system. He was the Eastern master that inspired Paul Twitchell's Ekankar, which became literally a pathworking cult. And very effective system, very hypnotic, very effective. And the attention points were the primary innovation in the Kirpal's program. In other words, Other path workings, what they would do, deriving from the far sphere group, what the early other path workings would do is they'd take you to a symbolic tableau or a inscription or something that they wanted to show you, a magical animal, symbolic beast, or something like that, and they would tell you exactly what it was that you were supposed to see and exactly what it was that you were supposed to experience. And that was the way they did it. And, that's a good idea and all of that. But Kirpal improved on this immensely. His idea was, and what we've used is to take you to a particular magical icon or esoteric symbol or meet some mythological figure or something like that, and inscription that you would read or that entity that would speak to you would speak, it would be strictly for you, and you would have to see, you would read, you wouldn't be told what the inscription was. And you would say, okay, there is an inscription over this arch. And look at that inscription and realize that it's significance and remember it. But they wouldn't tell you what it was. See, so you would have to draw this out of your deepest reaches of your unconscious, the collective unconscious. You would discover this particularly for yourself. Now, this, I think, Kirpal's inspiration here just really literally transformed path workings from a kind of a nice reverie where you receive instructions in a more hypnotic way. It transformed it into an actual initiatory experience where you're evoking this knowledge, this wisdom out of your deep mind, out of as well, those of us who are on the Jungian wavelength, we would say out of the collective unconscious, which is in a sense the universal mind. So you're really, really getting the deepest meanings. Now, that said, so the paths lead to the sphere, and the paths, the symbolism along the paths relates to the sphere. But what we do, because I feel like the Golden Dawn did go short on the spheres as far as we consider that a path working goes the length of the path and then into the sphere itself. So as far as we are concerned, you do a path working on the Hermetic Tree of Life, and you're doing not just the path itself, you're doing the path and the sphere goes to. Now that that solves the problem of actually being able to experience the sphere, which you should, because the sphere is, when you get right down to it, that's where it's at. I mean, that's where the wisdom and that's where the experience and that's where the particular universal theme that you're going for, that's where it is. So remember that in our pathworkings, we're using Kerpole's attention point system, and we're going into the sphere itself and experiencing the sphere itself. That becomes the temple of the gods that are related to the sphere. That becomes the holy city if that happens to be related to the sphere. And you're not just a path working, it's a path to a sphere working. And this should really be understood. Now, with that in mind, let's talk about, we have two spheres here that we're dealing with. The sphere we're coming from and the sphere we're going to and the path in between. And in this case, it's the 23rd path. And it's in between Aud, that's Mercury, that's the sphere of the intellect, that's the sphere of rational reason and technical expertise and vast knowledge. I don't know how much wisdom is in Hawk, but there's an awful lot of knowledge in Hawk, let's put it that way, and an awful lot of expertise that's in, and a great deal of rationality. Probably a lot of Aristotelian logic and probably running a little short on non-Aristotelian logic. But anyway, that's Haud. And our version of Haud, the sphere itself, is the great library. The great library and laboratory of the ages. When we take you on a path working to Haud, we're going to take you through the path of Shin and through the desert and through the salamanders and all the rest of that. But then we're going to get you to the library. We're going to take you up on the top of the mesa. We have this huge library of the ages, a laboratory in the basement, and the well of the universe in the center, because that's supposed to be a water temple. So we have the well of the universe in the center of the library, so you walk around the rotunda and look down into the well of the universe and all that. So then you have access to, it's like Super Google, it's like the ultimate internet where you have access to everything, and like Wikipedia to the ninth power, everything is there. Everything that was ever recorded, the Akashic records, that is the whole business. However, it's the same thing as Wikipedia and Google and everything. It's up to you to make sense out of it. It's up to you to separate the truth from all the whatever. It's up to you to be able to see the Fenords. Okay, remember what a Fenord is? Remember, we were. Doing the one on Phoenician Jesus, I used the example of the Fenords with the Bible, and the Bible, when Ezra and Cyrus wrote the Bible, they couched it in terms that would make the tribe of Judah and Benjamin and the Levites, it would put them in a good light and give them a lot of power. They wrote it this way, and I use the example that Robert Anton Wilson came up with in the Illuminatus trilogy. This little punctuation mark that some Dutch printer had developed back in the 17th century, developed this little punctuation mark, and it was called a Fenord. And you took a Fenord when you want to indicate that a particular sentence or a phrase or a word or something was specious. In other words, it wasn't quite true, or it wasn't quite, you were, if there was some kind of exaggeration or distortion involved here with that word or that phrase, you put a fenord around the word or the phrase, and you put this little fenord there, and then people would realize that, well, this isn't really true, but we're you know, but they want us to say this anyway. And so, but then what happened was that that fenords kept being used, but then people could gradually stop being able to see them. They couldn't see them anymore, and so they believed all this stuff that was in fenords, and they didn't realize that it was is the fenord, because their minds just put they put the fenords out. So then in the Illuminatus trilogy, there was this fellow was sitting on a park bench when he was reading the paper. All of a sudden, he jumped up and screamed, "I can see the fenords!" So, actually, Hod has a tremendous amount of information and a tremendous amount of data and a tremendous amount of engineering and scientific knowledge and everything else. But if you just go in there, you better be able to see the fenords. That requires... And it requires non-Aristotelian logic, and it requires a number of things. But some of that will be gained on the way to Tiphereth, and some of it may be gained, hopefully, on the way to Gabura. Now, it needs to be gained on the way to Gabura, and this is one of the reasons for this path, this water path up there. And one of the reasons for that mysterious selection of that mysterious hanged man card, you need to be able to see the fenords, and you need to be able to get your head on straight when you go to Gabura, because Gabura is the sphere of dynamic and sometimes aggressive action. So before you take all of this technical stuff that you've learned down in, because you see, the thing about Hod and about the intellect and about the whole idea of it's just kind of devilish, because there's not much morality or ethics or anything there. There's just a tremendous amount of knowledge. As I say, knowledge is power. But neither knowledge or power are wisdom. Okay, so and by the way, let me put another analogy on Hod before we pull out of Hod here and or fly over Hod and take off for Gabura. Let me say that Hod is attributed to the planet Mercury. Now Mercury, of course, as attributed to the god Mercury and god of the intellect, and that's Mercury, that's Hermes, that's Thoth, that's Cusor, that's Tubal-Cain, that's, you know, Hephaestus, all the craftsmen and the clever god forms you can think of. Now, the planet Mercury doesn't revolve. The planet Mercury has one side always to the sun. That's absolutely incineratingly hot. It's so hot that it's inconceivably hot. It's really hot. The other side is freezing, icy, super sub-zero cold, and there's no in between. Oh yeah, you could say, well, maybe there's a little twilight zone there where you might be able to catch a breath before, you know, before your one foot burns, the other foot freezes. But that analogy, in a sense, fits Hod, because all of this knowledge and all of this wisdom and all of this, well, not wisdom, all of this knowledge and all of this this expertise and all of this scientific acumen and everything else can be used for great good, or it can be used for great evil. It can go either way. And, I mean, of course, immediately the atomic bomb comes to mind, you know. I mean, we go, my God, what have we unleashed? And things like this. But also, too, got to think about the devil in relation to Hod. The devil, somebody once wrote a serious book on the idea that everything men do is kind of devilish, and women have to come along and sort of, you know, clean it up and try to mollify it. But just about every creative thing a man does or tries to do ends up causing more trouble than it actually is. And when you think about it, you know, this is almost it might be true, you know, actually, because technology, on the one hand, makes us a lot more comfortable and all of that, but then on the other hand, it have terrible pollution and wars and you know, and that sort of thing. So anyway, so this is what we got. This is sort of the downside here on Hod. Now, so going up to Gomorrah, which is the sphere of all kinds of aggressive action and severity and war and destruction if necessary and you know, whatever. Gomorrah is a harsh place. Okay, so going up there, we need something to kind of cool us down, and get our heads on straight before we go. So the path is attributed to water, the letter Mem, and it's pictured as stormy ocean. I know John Michael Greer has some really nice symbolism. He talks about underwater caves, and oh boy, I remember my cave diving experiences. That sort of rings a bell. Sunken ships and all this great ocean here. But it is also that ocean is a challenge and it's fearsome. One might even imagine the perfect storm or whatever. But it's called destabilizing intelligence. Why is it? Well, you might say it acts as a solution and acts as a solvent for some of the brittle, overly aggressively creative stuff that comes out of Hod before you get to Gomorrah, where you would end up using it. Say, for instance, you know, okay, we designed this weapon down in Hod, and we got this thing designed, and we got it all, you know, in the box along with all of its magazines and its ammunition and all of its accessories, whatever. So we'll take it up to Gomorrah, and then we'll mount it and start firing. Well, maybe by the time we get it up to Gomorrah, you know, we'll look at it and we'll say, oh, I don't know. I don't think we should go firing this thing at anybody. let's reconsider this. So hopefully, now this brings us to the symbolism of the hangman. Now the hangman card. And this is something that John Greer brings out, which I didn't know until I read that book, that the card originally meant that this upside-down person hanging by one foot upside-down symbolized a traitor, and the card was called the traitor. Now, John Greer points out that Mussolini, when he was finally shot by the partisans in Italy, they hanged him upside down because that was... I got another call. Who am I speaking with?
Hey, folks, it's Frater Solomon.
Oh, hey there. Hey there, Frater Solomon. We're talking about the 23rd path, and, you know, that's Mem, that's leading from Hod up to Gomorrah. And you got any thoughts on that one or no?
Well, yeah. On some of my deeper visionary trances, kind of an interesting thing. It's a little bit disturbing, but sometimes when you delve really into your creative mind and you just allow it to flow, you're going to get a lot of violent images eventually. And I think that's kind of what you experience when you have all this creativity and you just keep dancing it and keep trying to throw images around. You got to rip images up, and naturally not everything is going to be positive. But I do think on the upside, once you get into Vera and you can realize what it's about, you can, as it were, swim through that that sea of blood and then come on the other side realizing what part of yourself you need to get rid of. Because we all have that. Gavura is really a good sphere to deal with anger issues that you have, and having a good fighting spirit but not having a bitter attitude. I think that that's one of the things that you really get from Gavura. Also, what do you think about maybe Odin being the Hanged Man?
That's an interesting thought. I thought, yes, because he did sacrifice himself on a tree, personally, now I was going to get into this, that my personal thing that I like to use, and I worked it into our version of the pathway, is Achilles being dipped into the river Styx by his mother. Remember that? She made him invulnerable except for his heel, and dipped him, you know, held him by one, just held him by his heel, and dipped him in submerged him in the river Styx upside down, and then pulled him back up, but because his heel was didn't go below the water, eventually. Now, he was absolutely invulnerable and a great warrior. And then finally, I think Hector, it was Paris, actually, because I think he killed Hector. He was dragging Hector around behind the chariot around the walls of Troy. And I think it was Paris, wasn't it, that shot him in the heel with an arrow?
You know, I don't know the Achilles story very well.
I think that was it. But anyway, I thought the symbolism of this because you notice he's upside down, he's got a halo kind of, and he's sometimes he's over water, the usual interpretation is it's some kind of sacrifice. That it's some kind of sacrifice, but one of the both Basil and Jan Michael Greer, they both kind of indicate that this is indicates a complete change of perspective. You know, in other words, the Hangman is this is transformation, and you're sacrificing yourself, but it's a totally different. In other words, everything's turned upside down. It's kind of a metaphor, I think, for that. Where he looks like, you know, when you see him, he looks like he's perfectly happy. His face, you know, he's smiling. He's got this halo, and
almost like an upside down angel.
Yeah, right.
You know, Peter was crucified upside down, Saint Peter.
You remember why they said
I
that? The idea was that. Peter said, "Oh, you know." Well, they told him they were going to crucify him, and he said, "Oh, to die like our Lord died." And they said, "Well, we can change that." So,
I wonder how much though of this symbolism's there. Peter's probably not the big one, but I do think Odin had an influence on this card. And I think there's a lot of symbolism on these cards that goes back to a lot of early European mythology. But the runes, I mean, that's something that's interesting because the runes are actually based on Phoenician letters. Because one of the things we're doing is divining the runes. And as we go up the Tree of Life, what we're divining is the meaning of each Phoenician letter as it is to us, which we get when we do our third degree working.
Yeah, David Myriad has a real nice series on meanings of the Phoenician letters. We have, of course, that Davies book, but you're still in doubt on that one. But the Phoenician letters, I think, we feel that they have great mystical significance, And this particular one is Mem, and Mem is one of the mother letters, and it looks like in Phoenician it looks like a W with a long tail, a long tail on it. And so you've got the water, the symbol of the water, and then you have the line down into the depth for Mem. And I don't remember exactly what Myriad has for that symbolism on that, for what his write up on that. But I know that the way the letter is written that symbolizes waves.
Right.
All
the Phoenician letters are pictures.
Now we fly over, using Kusor's boat. We're flying over over the water. Over the stormy water, and I like to take the each one of the folks that are going along on the trip, and hang them over the side and into the water, sort of on that my Achilles idea, but then haul them back in, and then they've had their baptism, so to speak, in the stormy waters, and they've had their upside down experience. And then when we land up at Gamora, and that castle of Anath, the warrior goddess, and that castle of hers is right on the edge of, like we say, on the edge of forever. And there's a, you remember, we have that bridge, that very, very narrow bridge across the chasm that leads to the castle. And what you were saying that you have to, before you get to Gamora, or before you get to the castle anyway, you have to master yourself. And
yep.
So that getting across the bridge, that's that experience. And I'm not going to, I'm going to spoil it for people, but it is exactly how we do it. But that's true. So then once you get into the castle and you confront Anath, her iron throne sitting there, and she's the traditional warrior goddess, and she wears the eagle helmet, and has the necklace of human heads, and that skirt made of human hands. And what so many people don't understand about this is, this is. I was just reading the other night. I was just going back over the Malinoth legend, just to confirm this. In this is really amazing. In 1500 BC, Anath is described as wearing this necklace of severed heads and this girdle of human hands, and this is exactly the same symbolism you get with Kali, with Durga, with Vajrayogini, with the wrathful bikinis. Exactly the same. And here
when you
we
think
are
about
all
it.
The way. But yeah, but think about this though. This is all the way. In other words, there is a direct connection between Anath and those goddesses over in India and in Tibet.
Well, we all had to come through Phoenicia when we came, just about everybody, all the cultures in the world that left Africa through Egypt had to come through Phoenicia. That was Phoenicia and Mesopotamia really were the heartland of most human cultures.
Well, this is true. And now we know, of course, that the Phoenicians didn't just come up from, they weren't a bunch of grubbing Bedouins that came up from Sinai. In 2000 BC, they were there, and they were civilized for 11,000 years, right there.
Yes,
I mean, we know that now. Yeah, and we know also that they were the ones who actually transported building materials and craftsmen and everything else down to Egypt to build the great monuments of Egypt. And so the Phoenicians are not late comers at all. They are very early comers. And so this is very significant. But in the Gomorrah experience, though, what a lot of people don't realize, and in fact, I have not read it anywhere else. We determined it, you know, from our insights, in contact with the deities. The meaning of Anath's severed heads and her girdle and hands. The severed heads are your previous incarnations, and the severed hands are your deeds. And so when you confront her, you are looking at, she is the keeper of all of this karma of yours, and she has it all, and she doesn't forget anything. And she's a very, very stern and very judgmental, very harsh, and yet she's fair, and so if it's seen in the right way, Anath is very valuable to you. She can humble you, and rather than you know. If necessary, she can humble you, and also, if necessary, she can empower you. She also, now this is what we do. You go to Anath, and for the first time, or for any time that you need to, and she will assign to you a weapon, and you don't know what the weapon's going to be, but she will assign it to you, and that weapon is yours. And you take it out of her weapon rack, and that weapon is yours, and then she will charge you with how you have to handle it, and what you have to do with it. And so this becomes a very, very, very empowering thing. Now, by the way, we should mention that we in the Western psychic center or chakra system, Anath Gomorrah is in the throat, which is the sphere of, speech is what we use to reach out and do things. It was Basil Wilby of Gareth Knight who said that, in comparing the opposites, has said over on the pillar of mercy, has in its opposite, Gomorrah, on the pillar of severity, that chesed is the sphere of what the individuality is. I love the way he puts this. It's the sphere of what the individuality is, and Gomorrah is the sphere of what the individuality does. How do you like that?
I like that.
Yeah, that's a good one.
That's a good expression.
That reminds me, when you're talking about Hod, who was the guy that said, men do and women are? Well, I think that's a little chauvinistic.
Maybe the opposite's true.
Well, actually, if you're tantric, yes, the opposite. Shiva just sits there. And Shakti wiggles like crazy. and you get right down to it. So actually, but this idea of Hesed being the sphere of the individuality, and as it is, and then Gomorrah is the individuality as it does. And so the proper place to put Gomorrah is right smack in the throat, because you can hope very, very much that maybe you won't say the wrong thing. but the path leading up with the hangman, the idea is, let's have a transformation. Let's turn things upside down. Let's don't be as quick to hate and pull the trigger and all that. If we can first learn to subdue our passions and look at things differently, and whatever. You have any more thoughts on that one?
You know, well, there's two things that come to mind, and I never thought about it really until this evening, since we really delved into it. When you're hanging upside down for a prolonged period of time, all the blood in your body starts rushing to your head, and this will actually create its own sort of trance state. And one thing you're actually doing is you're waterlogging your brain, and you're putting a lot of pressure on it after a prolonged period of time. And another expression that one of the new associate members, the brothers in our order, said to me that I thought was really wise was that iron sharpens iron. And iron is the element of Mars and war and Gabura. And really we have to, in order for things to improve in the world, we're constantly having to fight things. And the truth is there hasn't been a single war on the planet that hasn't started with words first. Misapplied words have led to wars. And so the throat chakra for Mars really makes a lot more sense than people would think. We have the saliva is created there, the water is created there, but also actions of war, words create wars. They create big wars, they create little wars, they create friction between people, but they can also pacify, subdue, and resolve situations. So that's really a good reason, instead of making the whole base of our being the root chakra Mars and having our own reproductive system equated with war, you're putting it in a place where it's a lot more intelligent to put, and it's also more productive.
Well, let me clarify that a little bit. In the Eastern, well, we shouldn't say that Woodruff serpent power or the most common Laya Yoga arrangement is the Eastern system, because there are other arrangements besides that in the East. However, that's the one we come to think of as the Eastern arrangement, as the chakra system of the East. And they do put Mars, they attribute the planet Mars and the Martian energy to the genital chakra. Well, you know, hey, yeah, there's women have testosterone, and you know why, and there is some validity to this. But I think in the Western system, we put the moon in the genital region, and I think that fits much, much better and is much more apropos, and certainly is a lot less chauvinistic. Not that we have to be, you know, we don't have to chauvinism doesn't have to dictate everything we do, but I mean, but still, yeah, we really want to have a gender balance when we consider these things, and because you know half of us are one gender, the other half the other, and so that this tends to be the case, but the Western system fits not only with our mythology and with our spirituality, but in our cosmic orientation as far as spirituality is concerned, but it also fits with the Kabbalah. And it is based upon the lightning flash of the Tree of Life and the Metal Pillar exercise. So that's something that that we've been finally starting to get successful getting this thing around and getting the weaning the Western magicians away from this away from trying to make the Eastern system fit with the Kabbalah, and it just plain does not. So in this case, yeah, Gabura certainly does fit in the throat. So next week we're going to do the 22nd path, and that is leading from Tipperef over to Gabura, and that is justice. Oh, boy. Yeah. Here come the judge. And so that ought to be fun. And Frater Solomon, I want you to call in on that one, too.
Okay.
Yeah. Now, that'll be next week, and we got to get over to Hesed pretty soon, and then we're going to have fun because that's where we put Atlantis. Yeah. And so, until then, all you people out there in Blog Radio Land, good magic.